Blog Talk Radio.
This life is mine. God gave this land to me. This brave and ancient land to me. And when the morning sun reveals hills and plains, then I see a land where children can run free. So take my hand, walk this land with me, and walk this lovely land with me. Though I'm just a man, when you are by my side, with the help of God, I know I can be strong.
Good evening, happy Shabbat. Welcome to Yada Yada Radio. We've got Kirk with us this evening. Kirk, another sad day for a disgusting institution. The number three ranking person within the Vatican, Cardinal Bell. He was Archbishop of Australia. And was brought in by Pope Francis to run the Vatican's bank. He was convicted the same week that the Pope was running his expose in the Vatican against child abuse, against priestly pedophilia. He, of course, the number three ranking person in the Vatican, was convicted of pedophilia. 1996, he raped two choir boys in St. Patrick's Cathedral. He was found guilty by a 12-person jury. It was 10 years after he committed that, or 20 years actually, after he committed those attacks of those boys that the complaints against Bell were made public, largely because of the great extent the Roman Catholic Church has gone and continues to go to silence its critics. And all the time he continued to rise through the church's hierarchy. By the time that Bell became Archbishop of Sydney, the country's top-ranking Catholic position in 2001, he was a polarizing figure, revered by many conservative Catholics, but criticized by liberals for his outspoken views. Oh, he was a fundamentalist. At a 2002 World Youth Day event in Toronto, Bell made headlines saying, "Abortion is worse and is a greater moral scandal than priests sexually abusing young people." Wow. He said, since abortion was always destructive of human life, can you imagine a pedophile wearing the religious dress-up of a Catholic cardinal, saying that abortion is a worse moral scandal than priests sexually abusing young people? I'm going to tell you that I'm not a fan of abortion, but I am a fan of choice. I'm both pro-life and pro-choice. You know, I was pro-life, he is pro-choice. But there's a huge difference between a woman deciding to take the life of an unborn embryo, particularly if it's taken prior to the time that it's viable in the first trimester. Mm-hmm. And her making that decision on her own. And someone pretending to represent God, paid by people to represent God, taking advantage of and abusing a young child who is there ostensibly to serve God. There is something far worse than losing one's mortal life, and that's being incarcerated forever in Sheol. Cardinal Pell, Sheol is longing to see you. In his particular case, this pedophile, the third highest ranking member of the Roman Catholic Church, had hundreds, maybe even thousands of prisoners outside of his door. And a couple of choir boys were imbibing a little of the wine juice, you know, that stuff that the Roman Catholic Church says that they transmutate or whatever they do to turn grape juice and wine into blood, which of course would be in opposition to the Torah if they could do it, and of course they can't. Well, they were they weren't drinking the blood, they weren't vampires, they just had a little bit of wine. Well, Pell decided that the best way to deal with that was to open up his robes, expose his genitals, and rape the two boys.
Jeez, what a piece of work.
It is just astonishing. And you know, Pell never took a stand in his own defense.
Well, that's kind of odd.
Nope.
I thought he would come up with some other lie. Or justify something.
Yeah. One of the victims said that Pell pushed him against the wall and groped his genitals as all this was happening. Wow. And it's just disgusting. Speaking of disgusting, the Macedonians have a new name. They're the Republic of Northern Macedonia. So that the Greeks can lay claim to the title of Macedonia. And of course, this is the nation most associated with sun god imagery. There's no other nation on earth that has more sun god imagery in their national symbolism and in their national anthems than Macedonia. Positioned beautifully to be the country from which the Torahless One emerges. And of course, that country is rife with the conflict between the socialist secular humanism, Islam, and Orthodox Christianity. And I'm convinced that the Torahless One will have a Muslim father, an Orthodox Christian mother, and he himself will be educated in socialist secular humanist institutions, probably in America. Also on the news this week, Kirk, did you as you notice what Trump's personal attorney, the man who said he would take a bullet for Donald Trump, had to say about it?
Well, I know he threw him under the bus.
Oh, my.
Yeah,
he said he was a racist. He said that he's making this testimony because if he loses the next election, he will never relinquish the White House peaceably. Yeah, he said that he ordered him to pay whatever her name is, Stormy Daniels, that $135,000, which is a felony, a major breach of campaign finance laws. I mean, that's an impeachable offense. That's a go-to-jail offense. You know, in fact, the Washington governor, who's now tossing his ring for president, said, "Listen, I've got nothing against Donald Trump. I really wish him all the best. I mean, I hope that he gets the top bunk." Talking about whether he has the top or bottom bunk in prison.
Yeah, I understand.
Yeah, it was a bad day for the president as it relates to Cohen's testimony, because there just is no way around it. And I'm really stunned by the whole thing, because had Trump simply not been so egotistical and lambasted the man and demeaned the man, you know, Cohen would have continued to be the good soldier, and Trump could have pardoned him, and none of this would have come out. But, you know, Trump just couldn't help himself. Ego ever ready to be defended, and, well, he's in a precarious position. And you know, I don't want to see it personally. I don't want to see him impeached. Well, first of all, if he's impeached, the man that would take over the presidency is far worse. He is a religious wacko. And I think it puts America in an even more destructive position politically. I think it would be a bad thing for the country. I'm sure you saw also that Netanyahu is on the ropes. His crime is receiving champagne, cigars, and favorable news coverage for favors. Can you imagine a president of the United States, and the worst that he commits is receiving champagne, cigars, and favorable news coverage, and he would be indicted? Champagne, cigars, and favorable news coverage? I mean, come on. What is it with Israel that they're so fixated on devouring their own?
I don't know. I really don't understand.
It's just reprehensible. I mean, listen, Netanyahu's probably got an ego the size of the billboards he's erected in Israel now, showing him shaking hands with Trump and proclaiming that there's no one else like him. And he may be a horrible human being. I mean, I don't know him.
Yeah.
But they ought to give a parade for a president that's the worst that he does. Offers favors for favorable news coverage, champagne, and cigars.
But he comes cheap.
Yeah, really. Yes, he's cheap.
That's all it takes, man. Yeah.
Yeah, you know, I can be had for an Oreo cookie from time to time.
Yeah.
Yeah, I might even be cheaper.
You gonna eat that whole cookie?
Did you hear what the French President Emmanuel Macron had to say earlier this week?
No, sir, I didn't.
Yeah, he announced that anti-Semitism had become a scourge not only in France but throughout Europe, and said it was almost impossible for a Jewish child to go to public schools. And he said the resurgence of anti-Semitism is unseen since World War II, not just in France but throughout Europe. You know, Eric, it reminds me of something that I wrote today. Mm-hmm. I had reason to turn to something that was in Revelation. Now, I don't very often go to the so-called Christian New Testament, but, you know, there are three books there that I think have merit. Matthew, to the degree that it's been retained reasonably accurately, and who knows, Yahokana, and to the degree that we have at least some old texts dating prior to the 4th century, at least through some the 17 chapters of the Revelation to Yahokana. But I had reason to go there because of a reference in chapter 18 of Yahshiyah to Cush. And although the King James and others want to put Cush as Ethiopia, every reference to Cush early on, at least in the Torah, and most all references really throughout the prophets put Cush in the area around Babylon. Mm-hmm. And so there is a definite association between Cush and Nimrod, for example, the first king of Babylon. Mm-hmm. Direct, according to the Torah. And so I had a reason to find out between that and the fact that the Yashagai 18 doesn't have some 12 descriptive phrases identifying America as I had originally thought when I did that translation, I guess 7 or 8 years ago.
Mm-hmm. How many?
I counted 60.
Wow. Wow.
Yeah, so now I've got 60. And I've really done, I think, a much more thorough job of delineating them. I mean, I'm lucky that I didn't get demoted or fired, having only coming up with a fourth of them some years ago. But there's just not a whole lot of people waiting in line for this job, so I got to keep it even with some fairly inadequate work. But it was fun to go back through, and the methodology that we are using now to translate is just so much better, which is that I never rely on the Masoretic term. And I will always look for every word written with the same letters and disregard the vowel pointing that took place in the 12th century CE. And by doing that, and by being a little more diligent on the roots of those words, yeah, I found a whole lot. But as I was doing that, it became obvious, I mean, just absolutely, that I was just talking about America. And this is a warning to America. And then I began to say, well, I've read this before. And come to find out that the Revelation 18 chapter describing Babylon uses the exact same description. It's the description of America here in Isaiah 18. And then it's not just there. The same description where Yahweh is asking his people to come out of her so that they do not endure her plagues is written in Yirmiyah. Which is the 56th chapter of Yirmiyah.
Now, does that also mean, coincidentally, does it also mean for the Yehudim to get out of the U.S. and go to Israel?
Well, that was the conclusion. So, you know that famous phrase, we even have a book that we've talked about, that's come out of her, my people?
Mm-hmm.
What Yahweh was asking is his people. And he's only got, if people are still in some way associated with Babel, they aren't his people unless they are Israel and Yehuda. It's only Israel and Yehuda that can still be associated with something as corrupting as Babel and still be considered Yahweh's people.
Yeah.
No one else. So he's speaking not to the world at large, but to Israel and Yehuda during the time of Jacob's trouble. Come out of her, my people, and her, you are correct. United States of America.
That's the first thing you think.
Of the Jews who do not currently live in Israel, 70% of them live in America. And so it became obvious to me that come out of her, my people, is Yahweh during the time of Jacob's trouble, pleading with Israel and Yehuda to leave America before she is inflicted with horrible plagues. And it's in Yirmiyah in addition to Revelation. So that was a real eye-opener for me. I had never seen it that way. I mean, you came to it immediately and we began to talk about it, but this was the first time it had dawned on me that that's what he's talking about. And you might say, well, I mean, you know, that there's a reason that 70% of the non-Israeli Jews live in America. Yeah, there's going to be a reason they have to leave.
Mm-hmm.
There's this huge uptick in the in the number and the popularity of conspiracy theorists. You know, the Trump MAGAs, Make America Great Again, the false news contingent, they're all conspiracy nuts. And what is the central, most prevalent conspiracy in the history of mankind?
Oh, about the Jews, the Zionists.
Blame the Jews.
Blame the Jews.
And America is becoming ever more liberal, socialist, secularist.
Mm-hmm. Which is exactly
when feminazis, liberal women, rally, they always want to be seen with the woman wearing a hijab.
Yeah, that's interesting.
When you look at the most liberal institutions in America's academic institutions, you see them being boycott Israel, harassing Jews. It is elitist to be on the side of the Muslims, the so-called Palestinians, the people that don't even exist as an ethnic group. To be on their side, to side with the terrorists against Israel, it's considered progressive. And of course, Orthodox Christians, particularly Roman Catholics, still pretend that it wasn't them, but Jews who killed their God.
Yeah.
And you put it all together with the influx of Muslims into the country on top of that. America is going to be untenable for Jews. And as tormented as Israel is going to be, it's the only quasi-safe haven for them. And so, God is calling his people home. And it's because of this enormous and unrelenting rise of anti-Semitism. Now, Kirk, I understand you did a couple of studies, one thorough, one quick. One was I had encouraged you and others to check up on Nazareth and made the claim that prior to the influence of the Roman Catholic Church, that there was no place called Nazareth. There could not have been a Jesus of Nazareth. That Nazareth was not the name of a city, but instead the title that is most appropriate for Yahusha, the branch.
The branch, yes.
And that if you were to study the Amarna letters, if you were to study Josephus, if you were to study all of the correspondence and steles written about Israel, written about dealings with Israel, every town and city, large and small, is mentioned. But there's no mention of a town called Nazareth. Now, one of the people who listened to the show said, he must be wrong because I can see it on the map. And there is affirmation that there was a settlement in this place going back into the Stone Age. Not Stone Age, but the Bronze Age. Yep. You'll find it on the map. You'll find it on the map. And yes, there were people that lived in this area, not consistently, but back around 2000 BCE, that have no idea if that place, the little settlement, the village, had a name back then. But if it had a name, it's unknown. And it wasn't continuously occupied several hundred years BCE. The settlement was abandoned. There was no Nazareth at the time Yahusha was born and raised. It's a title.
You can go to Strong's, Concordance, and you won't find it anywhere in the Torah, Prophet, and Psalms.
No, there's no. And think of all the different places in Israel. I mean, little places. I mean, just where there was a rock outcropping. There was a little pass between the mountains. Where there was a drinking hole. Where there was a well, a spring. I mean, where there were Philistines, where there were Canaanites, where there were the Amalekites at camp. I mean, every little place you can imagine is named. I mean, hundreds and hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of names. And here's a place that's supposed to be prophetically significant regarding Yosha.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not named.
Yeah. I don't know.
Yahweh doesn't miss a trick. No, of course not. So, what we were being told early on is that
Nevelah
is the branch. And he's not just an ordinary branch, he's off the branch of Dod, fulfilling the prophecy.
Yeah.
So, you did your homework, and that's what you found as well.
Yeah. It just ain't there.
Yeah. Now, last week you had also volunteered to look up Awon. Awon is a word that troubles me in some regard because it's inappropriately vocalized, transliterated, which is always a sign that it's like Shoah. When Yahweh uses Shoah twice in the third statement, the etched in stone, talking about how he will not forgive those who negate, diminish the importance of his name.
Yeah.
So it appears twice there.
Yeah.
And it's, but it's job, the way it's transliterated. There's no V in Hebrew.
No.
And it's S-H-W-A.
Yes.
And so it's got to be Shoah.
Yeah.
But then the Masoretes twisted it.
Yes, they did.
And I think the same thing is true with Awon. Now, I know why they twisted Shoah, because it says that what they have done, which is to diminish the value of Yahweh's name by removing it all 7,000 times from the Torah, prophets, and Psalms, is an unforgivable sin. Well, they just resolve that by changing the word. We'll fix that. Our words are better than Yahweh's words. So, when Awon is similarly twisted in his transliterations, I'm really skeptical. And, of course, it's just simply rendered every place you go, iniquity, right? And that kind of is the go-to definition.
That's the catch word, the easy translation, yes. And,
so what you find as you went through it?
Well, I actually looked up iniquity, and of course iniquity is one of those words like so many that are more philosophical as opposed to being a concrete term. But everywhere I went, they translated a Hebrew word for iniquity. One was one of the biggies, but there was about 10 or 12, I think, that I listed here. And the simple thing is was to say it was to perish, to destroy, to be destroyed, to twisted, iniquity, amiss, perverted. Awah, basically the first three letters, is to bend, to twist. I thought I had it twist Yah's words.
Yeah, so you ended up where I have gone every time I've done them. When I study the root, it's impossible. First of all, I don't know what iniquity means. Really?
No, I don't either.
It's a religious term.
It depends on what you want it to be.
Yeah, iniquity is a religious term. It's kind of catch-all religious term. Kind of whatever you want it to be. I know what it means to bend and to twist, to pervert.
Yeah.
And that's the essence of religion.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't create something new out of whole cloth. It instead bends and twists and perverts Yahweh's message. And so I look at Awon and I say, it's perverse because it is taking Yahweh's message and it bends and twists it. It's, to me, it is what Hasatan did in the garden with Yahweh.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's the first.
He created a new myth. He said, God didn't say. He just twisted his words.
Yeah.
Did he say that? Come on. Bends and twisted the words.
Yeah.
So anyway, that sounds like where you ended up.
Well, it was. My whole input was, the whole reason behind it was, what is the iniquity that Yahweh keeps talking about that separates you from Him? And every time I went to these words, the other part of this was I would find that I would go back also, besides just the roots and so forth, and the letters as well, but also I'd go up and I'd say, what's the first one, two, three, or four uses of it to give a better understanding of how, because he usually uses it, it's usually closer to the meaning, the heart of it all. And every time it becomes like a list of the first tablet in stone. You know, it's always used in, the iniquity was, they turned away from God, they started using idols, they worshiped Baal, they changed things, they twisted His word, and on and on and on. So and the sad part after that was that I started looking up the commentary. And the commentators, the ones, the so-called scholars, I would read their commentary, and they would say exactly that. These people in this particular verse, like in Yeshaya 66:17, which is in this section we're doing, they would say things like, "This is these apostates. They mingled the human rites with the worship of Jehovah." Of course, they would use the word Jehovah rather than Jehovah. And then they would go on and on and on, and they would worship a Baal and Astora, which is Asherah, and on and on and on, and they would list all these things. And the thing I was sitting there as I was reading, I was saying, well, wait a minute, you are a Christian apologist, basically, in your commentaries, and everything you just said is everything that your church does. Why don't they see that? Well, they either they have one of two excuses. They're either stupid beyond belief and have no understanding of what they're doing, but you couldn't write the way, you couldn't list all these things and be that stupid. So it has to be willful.
Yeah.
It has to be, they want to twist this. And I'm not the smartest person around, but I can read this stuff and figure out what a word says, and I can connect the dots to a pretty good degree now. And I'm going, whoa, this is so blatant. Yah has no mercy. Do they not read the Tablet of the Stones, where in the first tablet, everything on the first tablet is non-forgivable? There is no mercy for you here.
No. And I would think that the third statement on the first tablet is the single greatest crime ever perpetrated by
His name.
Humanity. And, of course, it is expressly a religious crime.
Yeah.
It is a crime deliberately and knowingly perpetrated by rabbinical Judaism and all forms of Christianity.
Mm-hmm.
And not only is it unforgivable, the crime of replacing and diminishing and negating the value of Yahweh's name, which is central, by the way, to both religions. If they did not do it, both religions would fall apart. And it's absolutely central to both religions. And yet, they can read this, and they know for certain that what they have done is unforgivable, and yet they will go and justify it right to the end. Any manner of lies that they can come up with to justify it, they will do.
Well, who are they trying to
do? They can't be that stupid, so they're doing it deliberately. Why would you claim to speak for God when you're doing something that He says is unforgivable?
Well, you have to disassociate yourself and say, I'm doing this for the church, and God told us to have a church, which He never did. He never gave any instructions about a church, how to run a church, or officers in a church, or any of that kind of stuff. He never, and Yahusha never supported any such concept. He was Torah observant. So there's no need for anything new. So, but they have to convince themselves that He said church, and therefore the church substitutes for that, and God approves it. But I couldn't go there knowing this. I mean, I'd be scared, spitless, S-P-I-T. I just wouldn't know what to do. You have to be so perverted in your thinking.
It was one of the questions that we were having a discussion with the fellows today. He cleans the bottom of boats.
Uh-huh.
A really nice guy. And I was talking to him today, and he said, you know, you're the only boat owner that's ever treated me like I'm a real person. Offered me a drink of water, that told me I could use the bathrooms at the house of the boat to change, that invited me on the boat after I had done my work to have a cool drink. And it was just, first of all, it was just astonishing that no one would even treat him as a human being. He's been doing this for years. But it was also astonishing, we're talking about, you know, writing and translating and the like. And he says, well, you know, you must be really smart. I said, no, that's it. Really, it doesn't have much to a smart. The big issue has to be, are you willing to go where the words lead? When you find out that something that you believed is wrong, are you willing to change your thinking? And if you are, then this is easy. If you aren't, then this is impossible. And that's the point that I don't understand how someone can be a theologian or a pastor and come up with and confront any one of the hundreds of absolute dead ends, like God's name.
Mm-hmm. Yosha's name.
And pretend that Yosha's name, or this mythical Christ, or a Jesus, or a Trinity, or a Christmas, or an Easter, or a Sunday, or a cross, or a New Testament, or a Gospel of Grace, or any of this stuff, and not recognize that they are not only promoting a lie, and living a lie, but they're contradicting the very testimony of the God they claim they're representing. You know, it's like the woman who chooses to have an abortion. I think it's a horrible mistake. But she's choosing to have an abortion. She's ending a potential life. Versus the Roman Catholic priest, cardinal in this case, who sexually abuses two little boys under his care. It's hard to imagine that people, as you say, can do this and claim to represent a God whom they contradict. It's why I guess I was so perplexed by Shaul, by Paul.
Yeah.
You know, how can you write 13 letters claiming that you were specifically authorized and only you were authorized to speak for God to the entire Gentile world, and that you were authorized to condemn Jews in the process, when every word out of your mouth was the exact opposite of what God actually said?
And no one picked up on it or chose to.
And there are not 100 people in the history of humankind since that time who dared hold them accountable. Well, this next statement, we're going to return now to Yeshaya 8:17. The next prophetic statement alerts us to something horrible, impending doom. This is the Magog War, a worldwide Islamic assault against Israel. Beginning in what may be the spring of 2027,
mm-hmm.
There's going to be a tidal wave of terrorism. The effect is going to be worse than the combined conquests of the Assyrians, Babylonians, Greeks, and Romans. It's going to be more pervasive and vicious than the Holocaust. And with these words, now we are witnessing the prologue to world war. Woe, oi, be wary of, alas, expressing dissatisfaction and a declaration of impending judgment as part of a prophetic warning regarding an impending calamity. The preponderance of the people of a great many nations. Rabim, both plural. A multitude of compatriots, an abundance of kinsmen related by race, religion, or culture. A large quantity of citizens and a great many individuals and countries. Even numerous groups and excessive followers. Who will roar in hordes of agitated and confused terrorists. Hamon is a horrible term. In vast multitudes of bewildered and loudmouthed militants flaunting their abundant wealth while clamoring emotionally with their worldly possessions and massively disorderly riots, which are extensive and excessive, with the population agitated and enraged, boisterous and crying out in turmoil, the masses congregating along with their troops for a military purpose in a disturbing and emotional manner. All of this similar to a loudly groaning and stormy nature of an enraged sea. Ama, confused and chaotic, uproarious and disturbing, intoxicating and snarling, infuriated, expressing the religious and political and social turmoil of an angry sea of Gentiles. They will come, or they will choose to be consistently infuriated, continually angry, electing to be driven by the winds of religion and political and social desires. Ama again. And then the corrupting roar of the destructive societal chaos, Shaon, of the people of these nations who are transformed while massing under a single religious and political leader, Laom, will be like the horrible, destructive, and desolating uproar of the flood. Forcefully and in great numbers, Kabir, capitulating to the will of another, they will continually strive to destroy, moving rapidly while creating an uproar. That's Yeshayah 17:12. That does not sound the least bit enticing.
No.
I don't want to be here to endure that. I don't want to be here to see that. I don't want that happening to Israel. Just every part of that seems horrendous.
Mm-hmm. That is indeed Jacob's trouble. He said it'd be worse than anything ever.
Yeah.
So, that's amazing. Oh.
This is it. This is after the Teruah harvest. This is the main assault on Israel. This is the thrust of the Magog War. I call it a prelude to World War because this is strictly an Islamic attack against Israel.
Yeah.
And so it's really not a World War. It's going to turn into a war. Or on the second phase, but at this point, it's a regional conflict in the most important place on earth.
Well, heard what Putin said this week about, I told you before he was talking about if he wants to get into a Cuban-like situation, he's ready to go.
Right
after that, he printed the targets of every place in the United States that they would hit. And then
I saw that printed in the newspaper there. And some of them were kind of funny in a way because they had once been a military institution, but were not anymore. But, it's a possibility because the media was kind of making fun of the ones that had once been, but were not anymore. And I was always, but maybe the Russians know more than we do. That they are still active. When I fly, I'm always flying over the Blue Ridge Mountains. And directly west of Charlottesville, there's two very large areas under the Blue Ridge Mountains that are blacked out on all GPS maps. And you don't have to be a rocket scientist to know that that once someone disclosed the nuclear capital under the Greenbrier Hotel.
Oh yeah.
Now you can take tours of it and see, you know, the it's got pictures on the back of the walls that look like the U.S. Capitol and like the White House, and it's got rooms for all the senators and all the congressmen and chambers just like those on Capitol Hill and offices for them and food for years and all that sort of thing. So then a nuclear holocaust, one that they cause, they'll all be safe. And it was exposed. You can take tours of it. That if you don't know our government, they built another one. Well, this time they built it under the Blue Ridge Mountains, a little closer to Washington, D.C., about 90 miles away, just west of Charlottesville. It's all blacked out. So, you know, it's... I don't know who they think they're fooling. But this does say that it's a preponderance of people of a great many nations. Now, and I said this is the prelude to World War, and you might say, well, a great many nations. Well, there are 50 majority Islamic nations. I think it's actually 55. Mm-hmm. And the preponderance of people within those nations are from most Muslims. So the preponderance of people within those nations are going to attack Israel. You know, and I did the math on this, and the minimum number, when you use that phrase, is 100 million. I did just fundamentalist Muslims of fighting age within Muslim-majority countries that could easily get to the borders of Israel. And the number came out to 100 million. And then if you look at Islamic minority countries where the vast majority of those Muslims would join a great jihad because they'll at least have more access to reasonable information, you can get the number can climb up to almost 200 million. But I think you're likely to see over 100 million Muslims in this Magog war.
And defend against that.
And they're going to Hamon. They're going to roar in as hordes of agitated and confused terrorists. I mean, can you be a terrorist and not be confused? Can you be a terrorist and not be agitated?
No.
I mean, all terrorists are agitated and confused, right?
Mm-hmm.
Part of the job description.
Yeah, you're hitting innocent targets.
Right.
It's not a military.
They're bewildered, they're loudmouthed. Yeah, they're killing people that they do not know, that have nothing to do with their cause.
Mm-hmm.
And killing them makes their situation worse, not better. You see, you've got to be bewildered, which is one of the definitions of a mom.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, religions like Islam make people exceedingly agitated and enraged. You know, I was talking with a friend about Buddhism.
Mm-hmm.
And Buddhism is exactly the opposite. You're a good Buddhist. You're not agitated and enraged. You are peaceable and tranquil, right? That's interesting. We've all been led to believe that Buddha was the son of a Hindu priest, and he saw the suffering of the caste system in India, and as a result, he created a philosophy to bring inner peace when there was no outer peace.
Mm-hmm.
That's kind of the story, right?
Eightfold path, yeah.
Yeah, it's not the case.
Yeah.
No, Buddha was a Persian. And Buddhism didn't grow out of the Hindu religion, but instead out of the myths and twisting of Babylon.
Well, that doesn't surprise me.
But anyway, Islam is the antithesis of that. Muslims are emotional. Yeah, they're disorderly. They're riotous. They act in excessive manners. Population at large is agitated. I mean, they will walk through through the streets with parading in caskets. What they're claiming is dead little boys and girls. Of course, occasionally they set up and enjoy the view. But they celebrate death.
Mm-hmm.
Man, you have to be a religious zealot to be a suicide bomber. To think that you're doing something that's going to bring
your God,
some benefit to you. So Hamron is a perfect definition for Islamic terrorists. I don't know if there's a better word. Boisterous. Congregating as militants for the purpose of fighting. You know, emotional, confused, clamoring, loud-mouthed, and particularly in this case, flaunting what is an abundant wealth, Hamon. You know, Hamon is related to one of the words that actually formed Abraham's name. Abraham. And it was originally just Abram, and it became Abraham. And as Abraham, Hamon, is one of the related terms that says that, all right, he can be father of the merciful, or merciful father, and father of the enriched, or the father of confused terrorists. And Abraham was both, between Enoch and Ishmael. So we see both in this. This is God trying to paint a picture here, and he's using the sea to point the picture. And what does the sea represent?
Well, it's stormy.
Well, it's Gentiles.
It's Gentiles, of course. Yeah,
but the land represents Israel. Yeah. The sea represents Gentiles. So he's using something that is unstoppable, that we've all seen, stormy and enraged.
Yeah.
That can be chaotic and uproarious and snarling and growly and all those kinds of things. We've seen the sea that way.
Yeah.
And we know that the damage the sea can do, if you look at a hurricane, in most hurricanes, the damage is not done by the winds, it's done by the storm surge.
Mm-hmm.
You look at the tsunamis that hit Japan. Now, the earthquake did the damage, but the tsunamis were devastating.
Yes.
And so Yahweh's using the unstoppable nature and the destructive nature of waters. It's not only a metaphor for the Gentiles, but for the total destruction they provide and the fact that there is no defense for them. There is no defense for a tsunami. There's no defense for the surge, tidal surge of a hurricane.
You know, you've built your case so strong against the United States today, and as well as what led up to it. And this week, because I had time, I got to search a lot of stuff, and I went to the Canaanite stuff that you had already done. Just not check. I just said, well, what does it really say in there with all these things? And I read them, and they describe the Roman Catholic Church, which describes, obviously, the Canaanite religion and prior to that, the Babylonians. But it also describes the American religion. And then when you said last week, and we've talked about it before, but when you reiterated it last week and you were talking about you don't want to see it, but it's no way that it's not going to happen, in my opinion, that America will also fire on Israel at the end of this thing. This invasion, and then that will usher in gosh knows what. But what I was reading about was what's coming to the west coast of the United States. We already know what's going to come to the east coast of the United States, insofar as tsunamis on the east coast, and we also know about the asteroid, and then you throw in the follow up, which will be a nuclear war. Which everybody seems to want all of a sudden, you know, instead of mutual disarmament, they wind up, we're all stirring the pot. I mean, and you have to think, well, why does y'all want to kill America so much? If you don't read this, you would never think. And
yeah,
no, no,
and
today,
I don't. It's impossible to know whether or not Yahweh is involved in these events. Or these events are just happening, or it was part of the original calculation. Yahweh knew this was going to occur, and the forces were put in place to have it happen. But it is fairly obvious that the volcanic mountain that falls into the sea is going to be a hill, and it's going to create a tsunami that's going to take out the east coast of the United States.
Yeah.
And it's going to do so in a manner that is consistent with Revelation 18, where the ships at sea are sunk, and the superpower and the economic leader that's responsible for buying the goods of the world and responsible for trade is going to be destroyed. And it's identified directly with Babylon, and that Apophis, I think, is going to hit. We're not told, but boy, the symmetry seems to be the same, because Yahweh was specifically talking about, you need to get out of America before she's plagued. That's in Jeremiah 56. She's going to be plagued. You need to get out. And so I think that Apophis is going to hit in the Pacific.
Oh, you think?
Yeah. It goes to the Pacific, and Carne Viejo takes out the Atlantic coast, and Apophis takes out the Pacific coast. What's left?
Well, if what I read was in that article in the New Yorker, I mean, it, you don't even need that to wipe out everything from Sacramento to Alaska, all the way inland. I mean, it's amazing. But let me throw another thing at you. I know we're not physicists, and I ain't got a clue. But remember, I'd heard this before, and I think you mentioned it not too long ago, about when you observe an object in, say, a particle in the universe, and they record it, they're trying to look at it, and okay, it does this, it does that. And then somebody said, well, you know, if you are looking at it, it reacts different than...
Yeah.
If it's being light
does that. Yeah, light
okay.
does that. One of the most famous experiences of light is that you put a slit in a box and you observe the light going through versus not observing it. The behavior of the light is different.
Uh-huh. Now, if Yahweh looks at you in a negative way, perhaps by doing that, just by observing the United States because they caused him to, he may not have called the shots, but maybe that changes it too. I mean, that's a stretch for me, but I was
thinking. Yeah, and I am of the conclusion that when it comes to good news,
mm-hmm.
Yahweh never works alone. You know, I was writing the neck comes up in Yeshayahu 18 again.
Mm-hmm.
And any time the neck is raised, the sign and banner that Yahweh raises in the last days,
mm-hmm.
you know, I take pause because, well, I hope that God finds something better than what I've written and what many of you have contributed to. I genuinely hope that he finds a Israelite and a Yahud that does a better job. I really do. I'd be great for him, be great for them. But since there doesn't appear to be any on the horizon, when I read about it, I pause for a moment and say, oh my goodness, what's going on here? It's impossible not to see the fact that Yahweh needs a tool to call his people home because, America's going to get destroyed. And it became even more obvious as to why it had to be written in English and communicated in English, which is the language that every Yahud, Israelite, the world over speaks.
Yeah.
But why it had to be written this way and why the warning had to come from someone other than a Yahud and a Israelite. But God's not kidding around, man. It's really going to get nasty. And events are going to turn so nasty. The time of Jacob's trouble is a time of world carnage, of death. And part of it is that Yahweh is doing something that, and this was the point I wanted to make, that when Yahweh is communicating something that is important to him, he doesn't write next in the banners in the sky with his finger in light. He could do it, but that's not his nature. It's not his plan. His plan is to work through people, no matter how flawed they may be. Like I think he kind of gets a kick out of our failings. It just makes us more endearing in a way. And, but when it comes to man's bad behavior, God either lets man be destructive up until the point Yisrael's existence is threatened, mm-hmm. and then he intervenes. Mm-hmm. Like with the Amalekites, so the people you've studied, the neck is first mentioned in Shemot in the Torah. Mm-hmm. And in that case, Moshe is saying that I'm going to build this altar here, and I'm going to name it Yahweh Nessie. Yahweh is my sign. And it's because when Moshe was instructed to hold up the staff, mm-hmm. the Israelites prevailed over the Amalekites.
Prevailed, right, exactly.
And so Yahweh rid the world, personally intervened, to rid his people of those who wanted to destroy them. And that's why he said, this is Yahweh's, my means to communicate with the people, my means to convey what they need to know within the community for them to respond, and to respond in a positive way. And so my conclusion was that no matter how flawed we may be, so long as we're willing, Yahweh would much prefer to work through the likes of a Moshe, stutter and all, than he would go to battle with the Pharaoh alone. It's just his style. It's why he created the universe in the first place. But he will intervene, and so it is very possible, as we're talking about what's going to happen in this time of Jacob's trouble, we know that Yahweh is going to intervene to stop this flood. And only he can do it, the flood of Islamic terrorists. But what we don't know is if Yahweh is going to intervene to cause Carne Viejo to fail and that landslide to start that tsunami that takes out much of Western Europe and the eastern seaboard of the United States, and is he nudging Apophis such that it actually hits, and hits in a way that becomes the final plague for America?
Mm-hmm. Or it could hit space junk, you know.
Right.
And I mean, he just could be recording it, but it's strategically placed.
But the timing is awfully suspect for it just to be coincidence, don't you think?
I know. I don't believe in coincidence much anymore. I mean, the more you dig, the more you go, oh, okay, well, there's a reason for this, there's a reason for that.
So it's just the feeling that I have that Yahweh very seldom intervenes. He did intervene with specifically with Noah.
Mm-hmm.
He did intervene specifically with Abraham.
Yeah.
He did intervene specifically with Moshe and during the Exodus, and Yosha following it.
Mm-hmm.
There are times where he just stood up and said, "I'm going to."
I'm with you.
Do away with these folks. He intervened with Gideon, right?
Yes.
He doesn't do it a lot, and he only does it on behalf of Yisrael, only on behalf of Yisrael. He intervened on behalf of Hezekiah against the Assyrians.
Yes.
And he's going to intervene on behalf of Yisrael in the midst of this tsunami of jihadists. And he's going to do it personally. And there's going to be no doubt in anyone's mind that he did it.
Right.
But that said, when it comes to his neck, his sign, I just don't see him writing from the sky. If that was his style, why did he write the Torah that way?
No, everything is handed out through stone or scrolls.
Given to somebody, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
It's conveyed through someone.
Right.
Do you think that Yahweh could have inscribed the side of Moriah with the lyrics that Dod wrote?
Yeah, he could put it up on. He could put it up in the sky, and you could have to read it every day.
Right.
Absolutely. You can do anything you want.
Right. You could chisel it in the bedrock of Moriah.
Right.
But yet he chose to inspire Dod to write those words. That's just his style.
Mm-hmm.
So I think he is going to be consistent with who he has been. This sea of flood of Gentiles, they will choose to be consistently infuriated, uproarious, and snarling, angry. Hamah, a second time.
Mm-hmm.
God's making a point. And every time you look at an Islamic rally against Israel, it's always the same. They're snarling, they're confused, they're enraged, they're restless.
Totally.
They are Hamah.
Yeah,
Hamah. And in this particular case, it's interesting. It's the call and perfect paragogic nun, active Jusuf. I've never seen that before. And what it's doing is that it's saying that those who are snarling and angry and infuriated are choosing to do the will of another.
Mm-hmm.
So they have free will in the sense that they made this choice.
So they're doing
but it isn't their choice.
Or Allah. Yeah.
It's Allah's choice.
Yeah.
It's a really interesting, it literally defines Islam, which means one who submits.
Mm-hmm.
To submit, to surrender.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right.
To surrender to Allah. And it's a decision to surrender to Allah, which is Satan. And then the corrupting roar of the destructive societal chaos. Sha'on. Sha'on is a word, we've talked about it. I think we jumped ahead here because it was so intriguing to me.
Yeah.
Is that Sha'on is the basis of Sheol. It's also the basis of Sha'ul. Sha'ul and Sheol are written identically in Hebrew text. And Sha'on actually describes Sheol. It is a...
Oh, yes.
Yeah, it's a depressed, desolate, and lightless place where nothing escapes. It's just so fascinating how Sha'on speaks of a dark and massive black hole and depression which traps any object entering it. That's the definition of Sheol. And Sheol is the basis of both Sheol and Sha'ul.
Mm-hmm.
So here Yahweh is saying, yeah, not saying it for this reason, but we came to the conclusion long ago that Sheol, the way it is depicted, is essentially a black hole. It's a lightless place, which is infinite in time, the minimus in space, from which nothing escapes. That's Sheol, the place where Yahweh is not, his light is not. And yet now you read that the basis of Sheol is Sha'on, and that it's a black hole, and you go,
yeah.
Nice to have the affirmation.
You go, well.
And then to realize that it is identified with these chaotic, the societal chaos that is so destructive, so corrupting in the last days. You know, motivating Sheol, huge, presumptuous crowds of rebellious, confused, political and religious, brawling militants, terrorists, panicked into fighting while wallowing in their depressed slime pit. It's a horrible depiction of the fall of man. And the people of these nations who are transformed while massing under a single religious and political leader, Laom. Now, Laom is one of those words that I just couldn't resist. I had to know why Yahweh chose Leon, because in almost all prophetic statements, there are there are repeated words that Yahweh uses to describe institutions and nations. He's used both of them here already. Goyim, which is nations estranged from Israel.
Right.
And he uses it as Ham, which can be the family of man, be the family of God or the family of man.
Yes.
But he used Leom. And Leom took us some really, really interesting places, including to the what grew out of Esau and Jacob, Esau's sons.
Yes.
And the more I searched for the meaning of Leom, what I came to is that it was used when there are several words that can convey the same English words. It is our responsibility to look out what differentiates them so we don't use one word to describe three very distinct Hebrew words. And such is the case with Leom. And so as I study the word, the things that resonated through all of the etymology is it represents people of nations who are somehow transformed, somehow changed, while massing under a single religious or political leader.
Yeah, well, I got obviously religious nations.
Yeah, this strikes me of what ultimately happens when people are hoodwinked by institutions like Roman Catholicism and the Pope. What happens when people are hoodwinked under a caliph in Islam or an ayatollah. It reminds me of what happened in Germany and Austria under Adolf Hitler. Reminds me of what happened in China under Mao Zedong. It's reminiscent of what's going to happen under the Torahless one.
Mm-hmm.
He's going to transform the world. He's going to blend socialist, secular humanism, Christianity, and Islam. He's going to blend communism, fascism, and free enterprise. He's going to blend all of these things together, liberal and conservative politics, militarism, and talks of peace. And by blending all these things together, he's going to transform the lives of the people of this world to all for the worse, under a single religious and political mantra. So, Leom, people of population groups which gather together, politically and religiously organized, massing of people under a unified government or leader who changes them in some way.
Let me throw in one other thing, Leom.
Yeah.
The plural is means an Arabian community or Arabian communities. Here's a clue.
And so there is this prophecy in Islam that there will be a Mahdi that's going to arise that's going to unify the world of Islam in its uprising against Israel.
Mm-hmm.
And there is testimony in Yahweh's word about Gog, the chief prince of Meshach and Tubal. And how Gog is going to be the leader of the Magog Federation. So that's what I think we're seeing here.
Mm-hmm. It's the only way it fits. They're all
correct.
They are so much the same.
Yeah. Now, I don't think that's the only Leom in human history, because when Yahweh uses Leom in reference to Esau, for example, and Jacob, there are different Leoms. I mean, I think that to a large degree, the most prevalent and destructive Leom in human history is those influenced by the Pope under Roman Catholicism. But this particular Layom is a unified Islamic assault.
In the context of Israel, yeah.
And then Sheol again, the horrible and destructive, desolating uproar. You know, if you act in a rebellious and confused manner, you're going to end up in the pit of Sheol. That's why Sheol is such a... what it's conveying is that man left to his own devices is going to turn earth into hell. And so, Sheol depicts what happens to people when they're left to their own devices. They create hell on earth. So this desolating uproar of the flood of the waters of the surging sea, forcefully and in great numbers, Kabir, in abundance and seeking fame and fortune. That's really what... why Muslims kill. They want their families to be proud of them, and they're seeking the fortune of wealth in Allah's paradise and, you know, the harem of virgins.
Mm-hmm.
And they're intensely intertwined, extraordinarily, thought to be extraordinarily powerful, and yet they fight with a grating passion. Capitulating to a will of another, they will continually strive to destroy, moving rapidly while creating an uproar. They're going to Islam, surrender to the will of Allah. They're going to ruin everything they touch, Shah, devastating themselves in the process, leaving lifelessness in their wake.
It reinforces it, crashing.
Yeah, and it, of course, is all again with an oil, so... This is what's going to happen. If you don't want to be part of that, then you need to embrace the terms and conditions of the covenant. And you need to come to know Yahweh, understand who he is and what he's offering, and embrace the terms and conditions of the covenant. Attend his 7 annual meetings. He's wonderful.
Yeah.
And your choice to participate in the covenant ought not be motivated by your desire to avoid the world's most deliberate, debilitating terrorist attack.
Yeah.
It ought to be for no other reason than Yahweh's spectacular, fun, enlightening, uplifting. He's everything you could ever want in an individual. He's worth knowing. And you ought to choose to engage with him because of who he is, not based upon what you're being spared from. So I think I misspoke there. Unless you want to get to know Yahweh and be part of his family and forego that which he says needs to be eliminated from your life, and that would be religion and politics and militarism and patriotism. Unless that appeals to you, unless you genuinely want to participate in his covenant under his conditions,
mm-hmm.
and spend eternity with him as he has depicted it, then you ought not embrace the terms and conditions of the covenant. You ought not attend his invitations to meet. No matter how hellish the world's going to be in the future. Because for a moment I think that by saying, if you don't want to endure this, this is what you ought to do, I'm sounding a little bit like the Christian preacher that is saying, that hell is a horrible place. If you want to avoid hell, you need to be saved. And I don't want to convey that because, I saw a picture today because I was doing just a bit of research on the Netanyahu story.
Uh-huh. Right.
And Netanyahu's got these huge big billboards. He's shaking Trump's hand. And the pictures of himself and Trump look like they're, 5 or 6 stories high. And one of the pictures showed a fundamentalist Jew, very effeminate looking. And his black hat, his little curly cue come down the side. He's got his black jacket. It's just a religious Jew. Got nothing in his life to do other than be about it and said, you know, there is nothing more worthwhile, nothing more rewarding in life, nothing more beneficial than conveying Yahweh's message in such a way that Yah is able to use it to bring his people home. But quite honestly, well, I love Yisrael because Yahweh loves Yisrael. There's lots of Yisraelites that are just flat out unlovable.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I didn't write that for that religious buffoon playing religious dress-up. I don't want to see him in heaven.
He won't get there. He loves his.
I don't think he'll get there. I don't think I'll have to worry about it. But it was like a confession. I was just saying, you know, it's quite true that I don't love every Jew. I did not write this for every Jew.
No.
I don't want that religious moron to be my brother. I think he's revolting.
I've come to believe, if not totally know, that Yahweh doesn't approach you till you've at least walked away from religion and politics and in your heart, you know, and that you really want to know who God is. And I don't think you can get there without that. I haven't met anyone in covenant members who, even when we disagree about this, that, or the other, they all agree with one thing, that they were looking, searching for Yahweh. And when they found him, they immediately, if not, he sometimes took a little longer to get away from, walk away totally from Babylon, but they had already walked away in their mind looking for something that had to be true. And when they find Yahweh in the Torah, then they go on this great long journey to know more and more and more, and they don't seem to ever quit thinking about it and studying it.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, even that statement, come out of her, my people, when Yahweh was speaking to Israelites in America during the time of Jacob's trouble.
Yes.
I don't think he's speaking to the religious. I don't think he's speaking to those who have spent their entire life celebrating the Jewish culture.
Yeah.
I mean, part of the Jewish culture. Because they're not going to listen to him.
No, I don't think they will.
But the majority of Yehudim, Jews living in America, are agnostics.
Mm-hmm.
And the world's going to get so messed up, particularly for Jews, that it's going to be really hard to be an agnostic.
Mm-hmm.
And so there are going to be a lot of Jews who are going to turn to things like what we've written here, realize they have been misled all their lives, that their argument against God was just an argument against religion, that God's really likable and knowable and enlightening. And when he calls them out of Israel, they're going to pay attention to the sign.
Mm-hmm.
And they're going to leave when they ask calls out of America, I'm sorry, and into Israel. So I think even then, he is only speaking to those who have already realized that religion and politics aren't the answer. And those who are going to continue to embrace religion and politics and the culture of Judaism, they're not going to listen to him. They're going to do something they like right along with America.
You know, everybody, it seems like everybody knows that this is breaking apart rapidly. I mean, the people out here in California, they're moving out of the state. We're getting taxed out of our mind in the sense of, you know, it's no advantage to go make more money because you can't keep it. I mean, they double our taxes, almost double our taxes just on simple things like tags are now $300, you know, to get a annual tag per car. And you just go, God, they ain't nickel and diming us. They just got everything, the PG&E, you know, they started the fire with their faulty equipment.
Yeah.
That's a $10.5 billion error. And they're not going to pay for it. They're going to just raise all the rates to pay off the thing. So to settle all the claims.
California is becoming almost impossible to live in unless you are a dependent, unless you are part of the gravy train of food stamps and housing support and welfare and the like.
Yeah. Well, you can.
Unless you're working for the government.
Yeah. Well, I'm in a neighborhood.
No, it's just not a place. Otherwise,
no.
It's not universally true. I mean, there's Apple still survives there, and Tesla still survives there. I mean, there are some companies that still manage to survive with headquarters in California, but the vast preponderance have moved out.
Yeah. So, I mean, but anybody on this seems to think, boy, this is something is so wrong here. So, and they're not even being attacked in a sense. They might be overtaxed, but they're not being attacked like you heard them would be attacked. I mean, so I think it's going to turn around rather quickly, I'll start to say. I would hope.
Yeah. So this is a horrible, horrible time for Israel. Now, one of the things I did, and I don't think that it's necessary here, but I did try to figure out, well, how many Muslims is this really going to be? And how are they going to flood into Israel? What I came to the conclusion is that a lot of them, under this scenario, are going to flood in aboard ships sailing across the Mediterranean. You know, these Muslim militants will have been indoctrinated to despise Israel and Turkey, Lebanon, Morocco, Algeria, Tunisia, Libya, Egypt, and Cyprus, all of which exist along the Great Sea. France, Spain, and Italy are home to more than 8 million Muslims. Also, the Baltic nations around the Mediterranean have large Islamic populations, especially Bosnia, Albania, Kosovo. But let's not rule out the Islamic jihadists and the Caucasians who will likely sail across the Black Sea and through the Bosphorus Straits into the Aegean Sea before washing ashore in the Promised Land. The nations they hail from might include Kyrgyzstan, Tajikistan, Afghanistan, Turkmenistan, Uzbekistan, Kazakhstan, or Chechnya. And then from the south, in sailing up the Red Sea, we might expect jihadists from Somalia, Sudan, Chad, Niger, Mali, Nigeria, Yemen, Qatar, Bahrain, Kuwait, Abu Dhabi, Oman, Pakistan, Bangladesh, Myanmar, Indonesia, Malaysia. Just think of how many millions of Muslims could flood into Israel across the sea. And while that covers the Muslims who may approach from the seas, we should also consider the floodwaters and recognize there is but one floodplain in Israel, and it's in the Galilee, just below the Syrian Golan Heights. And it's now through this vulnerable portal that we might expect millions of mujahideen from Syria, Iraq, Iran, Jordan, and Saudi Arabia to flood into Israel. And as I shared earlier, there's one final potentiality, one I hope is inaccurate. But since this chapter delineates the negative consequences of America's intervention into the Islamic world, and the next adroitly describes the United States graphically, culturally, politically, and militarily, there is reason to suspect that the U.S. Navy and Air Force will engage against Israel in support of its Islamic political, military, and economic allies throughout the region. It's a very small step from providing Israel's enemies with copious amounts of the world's deadliest weapons to using them. So I hope this does not happen. I wouldn't be surprised if America not only supports the Islamic action against Israel, just as the British did in 1948 and in 1967, but also launches its own strikes after that war is lost by the Mujahideen. Now, Kirk, you know, there's 1.5 billion Muslims in the world. Many of them are jihadists. They comprise a majority in over 50 nations. Controlling those places while influencing the rest of the world with their carrot and stick, OPEC oil, and terrorism. Mm-hmm. Well, have you seen the charm initiative that that Crown Prince Mohammed is leading, you know, right after Pakistan had one of the fundamentalist Islamic terrorist groups, the Army of Mohammed, bludgeon and murder scores of Indians in Kashmir. That the Saudi Arabian, the hairy one, the man that that had the reporter Khashoggi murdered and dismembered, shows up there and embraces the leader of Pakistan as Muslim brothers forever. And then he hauls off and goes to China and does the same thing, but not the Muslim brothers. But it's like, okay, I'm rich. I've got oil. And he's such a disgusting, such an ugly, such a reprehensible human. And he's running around doing that sort of thing. And under the Trump administration, nobody wants to say a single bad word about him. It's far more important to Trump to sell them more weapons.
You know, I hadn't realized it until Terry did some research on the who buys the oil.
Yeah.
The largest user of oil in the entire world, dwarfing almost everyone else, is the U.S. military.
Please pardon?
I couldn't believe it. It was a huge report. The U.S. military.
They oh, yeah.
Functioning without it. So, I mean, that's right. Obviously why you're in bed with it. It's not because we need it for the cars.
No.
Or the factories or anything. It's just if they don't get that extra oil, they're out of business, and then they can't control their world as they think it is.
Yeah, that's a really interesting point, that the U.S. military, more than any military in the history of the world, runs on oil.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, when I fly airplanes, I'm constantly diverted over air bases. That's because we're burning Jet A. For what? Well, those airplanes. You know, my son designs engines for GE, and there's a huge difference between the military versions of engines and the commercial versions. Low bypass, high bypass. Well, high bypass engines, which have big, big, you know, fans in the front, they go great distances on a modicum of fuel. That's the commercial version. The low bypass, they go really fast, but they guzzle fuel to the point where, you know, a long-range fighter is 1,200 nautical miles, which means it can only go 600 miles in any one direction and make it back to a base or an aircraft carrier. And a commercial airliner like a 777 can go 7,000 miles and carry 300 people versus 2 people. You know, the U.S. military doesn't give two hoots about efficiency. Just think about what is a tank you get? A half a mile to the gallon? You know, their personnel carriers have gone from Jeeps to Hummers. And it's, I don't call them Hummers anymore, but that's basically what they are.
Oh, yeah.
Gargantuan gas guzzlers. Yeah, the U.S. military is the single largest consumer of petrochemicals in the United States. Far and away, right?
Oh, yeah. It's staggering what they consume. All in the name of peace.
Sorry. A piece of this and a piece of that. Shock and awe, right?
Yeah, shock and awe. Just don't mess with us.
Yeah, you know, it has a lot to say about us. And Yahshua 18. You know, if you look at Muslims, though, that the best predictor of future behavior and is past behavior in their campaigns over the last 1,400 years,
yes,
and most certainly during the most recent 70s, Muslims have left little doubt that they are the ones most enraged against Israel, the most vociferous in pledging to destroy Israel. And they commit 99% of today's terrorist acts. They have militaries that are equipped for this very purpose. 1974.
Mm-hmm.
Muslims were given a reason to die by Muhammad, not a reason to live. They were given a reason to destroy by Allah, not one to build. So this battle is inevitable. Mujahideen by the tens of millions, and I think over 100 million, looting, destroying, and killing everything inside while shouting, Allahu Akbar, Allah is a mouse, will once again attempt to destroy God's land and people.
Sorry.
Oh, they just don't know. I mean, they just do not know how... I wanted the world to realize, and I've said it on so many radio shows, I've written it so many times, the origins of Allahu Akbar. Because it's just printed in the newspapers. God is great. Bull crap! That's not what it means. Muslims know that Allahu Akbar is the printer of fear. They know it was first used at Kabar. They know that Muhammad, armed to the gills, attacked a defenseless Jewish community of farmers who had nothing but garden hose. And before he bludgeoned them and killed all the men, enslaved the children, and raped the women, he had his goons shout Allahu Akbar for the first time. And they were taught to believe that it meant, my God is bigger, older, and better than your God. Their God would be Allah. Yahweh would be